Here's a, although this, the title of my sermon might keep you awake. Here's the title. Very provocative. Deliberately provocative. Could have given it three or four different titles, but I picked the most provocative title. Here's the title. How many members will go to the place of safety? How many members will go to the place of safety? Now, you're all thinking, I don't know. You're all thinking, Fred Keller's hasn't got a clue. Oh, I have a clue. I want to give some verses that give clues, hints. But I want to start by asking you, if someone had asked you in 1994, before Worldwide went belly up, how many people would you have thought would go to the place of safety? How many people would I? You know, we had over 150,000 attending Worldwide in Worldwide Church of God. 150. 150,000. Now think about that. If you say, well, maybe half will be Laodicea and won't go, and half will be Philadelphian and will go. You know, that's speculative. You might have said, oh, maybe 75,000 will go to a place of safety. 75,000. I might have speculated that. And maybe some of you might have speculated that in about that year, 1994. Or maybe before Mr. Armstrong died. You might have thought of that. Satan rebelled and led a third of the angels. Now, actually, that's kind of encouraging because two-thirds of the angels didn't rebel. If you think about a third, that's really sad. If you think about two-thirds who remain faithful, that's over half. Right? That's pretty good. And God allows Satan, not only did he allow him to tempt the angels, but he allows Satan to tempt God's people. I mean, starting with Adam and Eve, Cain, but you know, God allowed him to tempt David, righteous man of God. He allowed Satan to tempt Jesus Christ. He allowed Satan to tempt Ananias and Sapphira. So God allows Satan and the demons to tempt his people. And what did Paul write to the Ephesians? I'm not going to turn there. He says, we do not wrestle against flesh and blood. See? We've got to stand against the wiles of the devil and spiritual host of wickedness. That's in Ephesians 6. I'm not going to turn there. Verse 11 and 12. You know that well. So God allows Satan to tempt his people and to try them and to test them. And I want to turn to a verse that I'm looking at in a... It just hit me. It's Luke 18, verses 1 to 8. And it's a parable that we read a lot because it's concerning prayer. And it's about the unjust judge. And we all know it, about this widow who just keeps coming to the unjust judge and wears him down. But I read this, I guess this year, and I read it in a whole new light. I saw some things there I had not noticed. Now, you know that happens often when you read the Bible. You see something in a verse that you've read many times, and you say, you know, there's something I see here I hadn't noticed before. And that's what happened to me reading this parable, Luke 18, verses 1 to 8. Now, actually, the parable only consists, there are 8 verses here, but only 4 of them are the parable. The first verse is the introduction and a statement of intention. A statement of intention. And of what he wants to do. And then he has 4 verses that are the parable, verses 2 through 5. And then he has 3 verses, verses 6, 7, and 8, of the lesson from the parable. So let's just read it. Then we'll go back and look at it a little more. Starting in verse 1, he gives a statement of intention. Here's what we're going to do. Specific, those of you who were in Spokesman's Club, this is his specific purpose statement right here. But you're saying, but Fred Keller's, what was your specific purpose statement? Well, just to let you know how many members will go to the place of safety or won't go. Or other things. Verse 1. Then he spoke a parable to them. And here's the specific purpose. That men always ought to pray and not lose heart. Not lose heart. Verse 2, saying, there was in a certain city a judge who did not fear God nor regard man. Now this is a symbol of God the Father, and you'd say, well, he's not an unjust judge. But it's a lesson of how to pray. God's not this way. He certainly wants to answer our prayers, but you know, sometimes he just doesn't. Verse 3, now there was a widow in that city, and she came to him saying, get justice for me from my adversary. And he would not for a while, but afterward he said within himself, though I do not fear God nor regard man, yet because this widow troubles me, I will avenge her, lest by her continual coming she weary me. Now he's going to give the lesson, the conclusion. Then the Lord said, hear what the unjust judge said, or at least the parable. Verse 7. And shall God not avenge his own elect who cry out day and night to him, though he bears long with them? I tell you that he will avenge them speedily. Nevertheless, when the Son of Man comes, will he really find faith on the earth? It's a rhetorical question. Now, the lesson is that men always ought to pray and not lose heart. And you think about it. Why would you lose heart? Well, if you pray, and you pray, and you pray, and you pray, and you get nothing, and nothing happens, and you continue praying, and you pray, and you fast, and pray, and you get nothing, well, why would God do that? Why would he allow you to pray and pray and pray and pray and get nothing? And notice what he says down here in verse 7. Shall God not avenge his own elect who cry out day and night to him, though he bears long with them? He bears long. They're crying out day and night. This is not an occasional prayer. This is day and night. And he's bearing long. And it almost sounds like a contradiction because he says in verse 8, I tell you he will avenge them speedily. Wait. Bearing long and speedily don't sound the same to us in English. However, some translations have translated it as quickly. That is, he bears long, and when he finally answers, he'll do it quickly. But it was a long time coming. Now, when is this going to be? I mean, when I first came in the church, we didn't wait for answers. It was easy to have faith. Any of you been in the church since the 50s? There you go. 60s? I went to Ambassador College in 1959. And everybody was being healed. Every week we had Bible study on Friday nights. And they would start the Bible studies with news around the world, prophecies. It was an hour and a half. We had a half hour of news and prophecies, and then things that were going on. Then they'd have 30 minutes at the end of Bible study. The actual Bible study during the Bible study. The first hour was not the Bible study. It was about other things. And one thing they would often do is read all the healings. People would write in and would say, of course we didn't have, 1959, we had three churches east of the Mississippi. I went there from South Carolina. There was no church in South Carolina, North Carolina, Georgia, Florida, Virginia. There was a church in, I believe, the Chicago and Pittsburgh were the two first, and I don't know which one was first, probably Chicago. And then the third one was New York City. Carlton Smith went there, started a congregation there. So there were three churches. So, you know, most people that were in the church, if they needed to be anointed, had to write for an anointed cloth to Pasadena. And coworkers. And so often, we would get letters in saying, I dropped the letter in the mailbox asking for an anointed cloth, and before I got back to my house, I was healed. We had no deaths. Everybody was being healed. And I just, you know, I had just come in the church. I was 19. And everybody was healed. I just expected everybody to be healed. But you know, we had an elderly man. I'm 73. He might have been, he probably was in his 60s, but I thought he was an old guy. And his name was Mr. Starkey. And I think he worked on the grounds. I know his wife did. She had been Mrs. Dennis. She was a widow. And she and Mr. Starkey, he probably was a widower, and they married before I got there. And he developed cancer. And they would ask us to pray. I know they would. Gardner Ted Armstrong was giving a sermon downtown Pasadena in the Shakespeare Clubs where we met. We didn't have a big enough hall on campus, so we had to go down to the Shakespeare Club. And he was talking about faith and praying and examining ourselves and praying for Mr. Starkey to be healed of cancer, because everybody else was being healed. He wasn't being healed. And he stopped the sermon. And he said, you know, I didn't plan this, but I feel I've got to. He stopped the sermon. He said, let's all bow our heads and I'm going to pray. Let's pray. And he prayed for Mr. Starkey to be healed. Now, Mr. Starkey, shortly after that, died. Everyone was upset. No one had died. Gardner Ted Armstrong came back and gave a sermon. He said, you know why we're all upset? He said, we haven't had anybody die around here in years. They said, that's not the way it's going to work. God is going to let people die. We're going to get old, we're going to die. Now, can you imagine an atmosphere like that where the exception is where somebody dies. Well, I went out and I first went up to Portland, Oregon. Then we moved very shortly after that to Boise, Idaho. And I did my first baptisms in July of 63 in the Boise River. Really cold. I was skinny. Couldn't take the cold. I mean, it came out at the bottom of a dam up the Boise River. And that water going through Boise was cold, and I was putting these people under the water, and it was swift water, and I was just shaking and hoping they wouldn't go down the river. Dale Hampton, who's in the church, they had a 50th anniversary of the Boise church a little late because it started actually in March or April, but and he went out there for it. He's a member in Oklahoma, Dale Hampton. But anyway, he was the pastor, and it was first baptism for me, so he was kind of leaning from shore, listening to make sure I was doing everything right. And then he and I laid hands on everybody. And in the picture, which I don't have, wish I could find it, but there was a couple baptized the Rushes. Now, we called everybody Mr. and Mrs. back then, and we normally didn't use a lady's first name. It was Mrs. Rush. So anyway, this is 50 years ago. So anyway, why Mrs. Rush is standing hip shot. And the reason is she had been in a car wreck years before she came in the church, and her back was all crooked. Well, she got an infection, encephalitis, and was having a little trouble with that. And I hadn't been ordained yet. So one of the elders from Portland was over there, and he anointed her for the encephalitis. She never asked to be anointed for her back. Next day, she's standing at the sink, washing dishes, and she feels her back straighten out. Now, how can you get discouraged and lose heart when you're being healed of things you didn't ask to be healed of? I was ordained in 65 at the feast in Squaw Valley, and they moved us back to Baltimore. We were assisting Guy Engelbart with the Baltimore and the Richmond, Virginia congregations. And we had a Bible study. We started a Bible study after I got there in Washington, D.C. We had no church there at the time. We had no congregation meeting. We had members, but not many. And we'd get up and we'd make that circuit, long circuit, about 3.5 hour drive. And I had just been ordained. And back then, people all had to see the minister on the Sabbath. They had to be anointed or they had to counsel. You couldn't buy a car if you didn't counsel with the minister. Some of you may remember that. Anyway, Guy Engelbart had deacons standing out keeping the line as to who was to go in next. So I went into a room at Baltimore, and I would anoint everybody. And he was in the other room, and anybody needed counseling, they'd see him. You know, people just lined up to be anointed every week. I can't remember anybody who was not healed. You don't think that was encouraging for a new elder? Wow. I don't remember all the examples, didn't think much about it, although I do remember that there was a lady, an elderly lady, came in the church, and brand new. I had visited her, Lucretia and I visited her, and invited her to church, elderly and mostly blind. And not first, but after a while, she said, I remember she had this reading glass with a light, and she was trying to read things. She said, "I can, even with my magnifying glass and the light, I just am having trouble reading, and I so want to learn and read the Bible and read the articles and the plain truth." And she said, "Please anoint me that I can read." And the next time we saw her, I think it was a feast day, and she said, "Mr. Kellers, I can see your face for the first time." God honored that. The other one I remember was actually in the Richmond area. There was a family, J.C. and Geneva Dollar. His initials were J.C. He didn't have names. His father just gave him J.C. Said, you want a name? Fill it in. But he never did. He just stayed with J.C. Dollar. And Geneva Dollar, they had been married something like 7 years, and she had not, and they wanted a child, and she couldn't get pregnant. And she asked to be anointed, and she said, I have, for the last year, had amenorrhea. How many of you know what amenorrhea is? Okay, I'd never heard of the term. Two ladies and my wife, who's Geneva was the first one who told me it. It means your periods quit. And of course, when a person goes through change of life, the periods quit. But she was a young woman. And she said, I haven't had a period in a year. And so I anointed her, and I warned her. I said, when you got a squalling kid, you can only blame yourself. She went home and had a period that afternoon. Hadn't had one in a year. I've always been confused about that, because you and I know that in order to have a period, normally you go through a cycle. There's ovation, and did God already know she was going to ask to be anointed, and he started it? And yet she still didn't get pregnant for a year, but she got pregnant. And I'm sure that was frustrating to her. JC never complained about that year at all. So I wonder why. Anyway. She got pregnant and had a baby. Let's look at this. Let's look at this right here. It says, men ought always to pray and not lose heart in verse 1. And then verse 7, it says, though he bears long with them, it's telling you that avenging them, as if somebody has done something to them. Somebody's doing something. And he isn't avenging, he's bearing long with them. Then he'll speedily or quickly answer. Then he asks this question. When the Son of Man comes, will he really find faith on the earth? Let me tell you, it was easy to find faith in worldwide Church of God in the 50s and 60s. It was easy to find faith. So I'm looking at this, and you know, in this parable, he sets a time period, doesn't he? Now, this applies throughout history, doesn't it? Throughout history, this applies. Anytime we need all of us to pray and not lose heart, and to cry out to God if we need, day or night. But he says, when the Son of Man comes, that means that the time period this really applies is just before Jesus comes. And if you look at things, the healings began from the time when I came in the church. And Lucretia came in 2 years earlier. She came and started attending in 57. The healings, and then they just began to be fewer and fewer and fewer and fewer and fewer and fewer. And you'd say to yourself, well, we just don't have the faith we had back then. Well, God's just, in my mind, making us work harder. We still get some. But even in the Bible, we see there are times when God was intervening strongly. The time of Elijah and Elisha. Strong miracles. The time of Jesus Christ, the beginning of the church, when the shadow of Peter was healing people. And then it dropped off. God was calling thousands. And then you see, as time went on, there weren't as many who were truly faithful. If God were performing lots of miracles before Jesus comes, He wouldn't ask the question, will He find faith, would He? Yet the thing is, we have said, and I believed, and I don't believe it anymore, I believe that at the end time, before that the church and the ministers and others would be performing great miracles. Well, He will, through the two witnesses. And Satan will, through the false prophet. So there'll be a lot of miracles by just a few guys. But the thought is that we would really preach the gospel beforehand by just having great power all around the nation and the world. I question that now. And I still hear that every now and then. Well, before the end time, we're going to really start, God's going to start intervening and doing lots of miracles. And I'm beginning to think, wait a second. There are times when God performs many miracles and times in the Bible when He didn't. When He did not. There's another. We moved from Boise to Eugene, Oregon. And there was Mrs. Charles Crane living there. Any of you happen to remember the name Charles Crane? There was an elder for a while. This was his mother. His mother and father. It was Charles Crane Sr. And I don't remember her name. We called her Mrs. Crane. This was, remember, a long time ago. And she had cancer. Now, I got moved. I mentioned to you, I got ordained and moved to Boise. We went to Eugene for a few months before we went to Baltimore, I should say. And I was ordained at that time at the Feast of Tabernacles. But before the feast, we were a few months in Eugene, Oregon. And Mrs. Crane had cancer. Probably it was breast cancer that went back in there. And they said it had popped out her back, even. And we got moved to Baltimore, so we didn't hear much about it, didn't hear anything. And then the next thing we heard that she'd been healed. But it was interesting how it happened. It was at the Passover time, probably in, it would have been, we moved back in 65 after the Feast of Tabernacles, so probably it was right at Passover in 66 that this happened. I have it written at home. I saved the letter that came out about it. But she was near death, and two ladies offered to come over and sit with her Passover night. Mr. Crane had been with her day and night, day and night, day and night. And they said, Mr. Crane, we'll come over and we will take care of your wife so you can go to Passover. And then we'll take the second Passover or take it after you get back. And so they were there and she was struggling. Ms. Crane was struggling. And they heard her quit breathing. And they said, she's gone. And he wasn't here. Suddenly she sat up in bed. She said, I'm hungry. And she had no cancer. None. Not any. So even in 66, we were still getting some powerful healings. And we moved up to, and we were, I mentioned we were in the Baltimore, Virginia area. We moved up to Boston. And there were fewer healings. Even then, we moved up in 69. But there were two really exciting ones. One was, you know, back then we didn't go to doctors. And so there was a family named Langell. And they had a little girl, I would guess was 6 or 7. would be, and they were in Massachusetts, and this little girl had painful, swollen abdomen, and they thought, well, look, let's go across the line to Rhode Island and have a doctor tell us what it is. They weren't going to have the doctor do anything. They just wanted to know what it was, see if there was something they needed to do. And he said she has a ruptured appendix, peritonitis has set in, and you've got to rush her down to the hospital. And he said, I'm sorry, I can only give you 50-50 chance. Now, today, if it were something like that, they can do a lot more than they could back then. This was the very early 70s. And they said, we can only give her a 50-50 chance. Well, they put her in the car and they rushed back across the line in Massachusetts and came and knocked on our door in Massachusetts. And they... And I remember him carrying her in. Must have been probably a Monday, because that was our office work day and I was home. And I anointed her, and they took her out, and 3 hours later they called back and said she's fine. She was out playing. Wasn't even in pain. Totally gone. But as dramatic, we had a little girl named Lisa Jarris. I think she was 11. She was a twin. And she developed a brain tumor. And we had a man who came in the church who was a doctor. He quit his doctor profession. In a sense, he went to work for an insurance company going through their forms that people would send in. So he examined her and said she has a brain tumor. And she was getting worse and worse. They kept her at home. They had to get the dog out of the house because any noise would bother her. They had to turn the lights off in the room. Any sensory stimulation hurt her very much. So, of course, we anointed her. And we kept talking about it week after week. And it was asking people to examine themselves. Say, are you like Achan? Are you the one? Am I the one? Do I have some sin that is causing God to not heal Lisa? Because she wasn't going to live if something didn't happen. And my assistant and I, or associate maybe at that time, said, we will fast. And we fasted 2 days, and we did what Mr. Armstrong used to say he would do when he would fast. That is, he would study the Bible an hour, he would meditate on what he studied for an hour, and then he would pray for an hour, and then he would study for an hour, and then meditate an hour, and then pray for an hour. And he would do that when he fasted, and we did that for 2 days. And at the end of the 2 days, she started getting... she had been sick from the beginning to the end, 80 days. And she began getting better. She was not healed instantly. It took her 2 weeks. But her father said 2 times 40 she got sick, and 2 times 7 God made her well. But it was interesting because everybody knew it. Now, she was finally completely well enough to come to church, and she came to church during the Days of Unleavened Bread. And we held it over in Springfield, Massachusetts that year. And nobody knew she was there because she was a twin, an identical twin. And so they'd see this girl, they'd think, well, that was her sister. And then I announced that she was there and was healed. And I remember this gasp went up. And the gasp went up, we weren't having as many healings. Back in the 50s and 60s, people wouldn't have gasped. They'd said, well, of course, that's the way it's supposed to be. We moved to Florida. There were fewer healings. There was a lady in the... We were down in Miami, Fort Lauderdale, but there was a couple. We thought of them as an older couple. They were probably, you know, in their late 50s maybe, or 60s. I don't know. I don't think they were grandparents yet. They may have been. But their last name was Johnson. I don't remember the first name. And she had cancer. And she was dying. And we were all praying for her. And Mr. Johnson called me. I was not his pastor. Roger Foster was, up in Lakeland. And Mr. Johnson said, my wife's been healed. I said, that's wonderful. He said, yes. I wanted detail. He said, well, we were in the hospital here, and the doctor came in, and he said, Mr. Johnson, I'm sorry, but she won't live till tomorrow. And then he said the wonderful words that only a wonderful doctor would say. He said, Mr. Johnson, not even God could heal her now. She went home the next day. I said, Mr. Johnson, that's wonderful. What a wonderful doctor you had. And he said, well, I hope that was not the reason. I hope he didn't heal her because of what the doctor said. Well, 6 months later, she dropped dead of a heart attack. And they did an autopsy. She had no cancer. None. And Mr. Johnson became bitter. He was bitter against God. He was bitter against the world. He was bitter against Roger Foster. Look, we can all throw stones. He got his wife back and then he lost her. However, he got over his bitterness. He moved to the West. We know that because we were visiting my brother in San Jose, California, and we went down to Sabbath on the coast there. I don't remember the exact town that was just down on the coast. Anyway, and he was there. Years later, he had remarried and he was a happy man. But there's an example. But we did. Now, here's the thing. There was a healing in the hospital, which we would not have expected at one time. You know, at one time we would say, well, you go to the hospital, God's not going to heal you. He healed her in the hospital. But we also had a man named Elwood Young down in Miami area. And he was an older man. Of course, we were young. And he had cancer in his stomach cancer. And he was in the hospital, and he got nauseous, and he threw up in the hospital bed, and in the vomit was the tumor. And he was well. So we didn't have, but you notice I'm not giving you lots of powerful healings. We moved to Little Rock, and we had a few healings there. And I'm bringing these out because I want you to see the difference. I mean, a lot of us think, well, God doesn't heal. And I want you to see that God, the point of this sermon is what we're reading in Luke 18. That God is allowing us to be discouraged if we will allow ourselves to get discouraged. And He's allowing us to develop faith and cry out day and night and not lose heart. So if you really want to change the specific purpose, maybe you could say, my purpose is that we not become discouraged when God doesn't answer. Because right now, He does answer, but not as much. It takes, just like Lisa Jarris wasn't healed till we did some fasting. Now you might do fasting and then fasting and then fasting and fasting. But there are still some healings coming. There aren't as many. I do more funerals than I do baptisms. That's maybe true here. I could let myself become discouraged. Baptized a 19-year-old girl just a little bit ago. Wonderful young lady. Wonderful young lady. Wow. Appreciate God calling her. We went to Little Rock. A real country lady, Little Rock, Arkansas, came up. Madeline Holland. Before services, she'd been in a car wreck. Most of the car wreck damage was over, except there were some issues in her bones. And she said, the pain has gotten so extreme. She said, I don't think I can sit through services. Please anoint me before services. And she came up after services and she said, Mr. Kellers, while God was, and I remember she put it real cute, while God was delivering his message through you, he healed me. And the pain was gone. There was another lady, Daisy Baugh, her husband's Jimmy Baugh, and they lived down toward, from Little Rock down toward Pine Bluff, Arkansas. And she had a tumor in her abdomen, and they were going to operate. But Jimmy called me and he said, would you come to the hospital and anoint her? She went in the night before, and she was in the hospital. And, you know, you wonder, well, I will go. Of course, you asked me to come anoint you, I'm going to come anoint you. So I went down to anoint her, and I remember anointing her, very slim lady. He was slim. They were extremely slim. If you want to lose weight, figure out what they eat, because they're still slim. And I went down and anointed her. The next morning, I guess they were putting the ultrasound onto her abdomen to see exactly where to make the incision. Tumor had gone. There was no tumor. Just no tumor. Well, the one that surprised me in Little Rock, we had a grandmother in the church. She was in the church. She had two daughters in the church. She had granddaughters in the church. And her name was Ruth Manus. She died, what, just a few years ago, I think. But anyway, she still has a son and a daughter who attend in United over there. But this was back in Worldwide. And she called me and she said, Mr. Kellers, would you come down? My mother is in St. Vincent's Hospital. And she has a blockage of her aorta that goes down into the legs. And one leg, the blockage, you know, that is an artery that's behind, between the intestines and the spine. And she was 90 years old, I think. Remember? 80-something, anyway. She was near 90. And could have been upper 80s. And so she wasn't a member. And she said, now, her foot has gangrene, is working its way up the leg, and her foot is black and dead. And she said, there's no pain in her foot. But on her leg, where the gangrene is working up and it's dying, there's pain. Well, I'm driving across town, and she said, my brothers are here, and in the room, I want you to know that they are Catholic. So I'm driving across, and I'm praying all the way that God take this woman out of pain. That he relieve her. That he just let her go to sleep in peace. So I get there and I anoint her, but, you know, I'm asking God to grant her peace. And I'll be honest with you, I never once used the word heal. Now, you need to remember that in case you are asking to be anointed and you're in the hospital and things look dire and the minister comes in and he's anointing you and he never uses the word heal. You might want to say, preacher, would you mind using the word heal? I'd appreciate it. Well, I left and I was continuing to pray and I got a call when I got home. She was completely healed. Sitting up in bed, chewing gum, feeling fine. I was surprised. Somebody had faith, or God wanted to show these Mrs. Manus's brothers. I don't know if he was just showing them something, or Mrs. Manus had the faith. I'm just letting you know that you just, you know, if he's wearing a tie, we don't wear ties that much anymore. We used to wear a suit every day. Ministers did back in the 60s. We had to wear a suit every day. just grab his tie and pull him over and say, use the word heal, preacher, you know. Another lady, elderly lady, she was older. She was Mildred Newkirk. And a guy named Jimmy Reed used to bring her to church. He lived at Hot Springs. She lived a little further out. He'd drive out an hour, pick her up, and then drive 2 hours into Little Rock. And then he'd drive 2 hours back to where she lived and then an hour back to his house. So she had terrible arthritis. And she was so bad after services one Sabbath, she said, please anoint me. I am in terrible pain. And she, you know, she was one who was constantly sort of wringing her hands because these real gnarled arthritic knuckles, and she was in pain. She said, please anoint me. And they're on the way home, and she said to Jimmy, I've been healed. And he said, I know. And she said, how did you know? And he said, you quit rubbing your hands 5 minutes ago. So we weren't getting a lot of healings, but we were getting some. And here's an interesting one. Mrs. Charles Crane, who had been healed of the cancer out in Eugene, they actually were, I guess, from Texas. But anyway, they moved to Big Sandy, Texas, and in the area there. And we were living in Little Rock. We used to go down to Big Sandy for tabernacles, for YOU activities. And we saw her there, and she said, please pray for me. She said, I'm going blind. And we said we'd pray for her, and we did. And she told us, she said, I just won't make a good blind person. Her husband by then had died, as I recall. I don't think he was living at that time. So she was elderly by this time. And we saw her again down in Big Sandy, I guess the next time. And she said, I've been healed. I can see. My eyes are okay. And because we were having fewer healings, I specifically said, Mrs. Crane, what did you do to get God to heal you? If that's maybe it's not a good way to express it, but she was healed. She said, oh, I prayed and I fasted and I prayed and I fasted. And I said, oh, God, I just won't make a good blind person. And God listened to her and he healed her. Now, in the last few years, we've had some healings, not as many. Probably the most startling. This was in United a few years ago, and I was getting up in the morning. Lucretia, I don't think Lucretia was going with me up to Bowling Green, Kentucky, which is one of the congregations, my outlying congregations. And it's afternoon services, and I was going to drive up, and I got a call from Tommy Gardner, who lives actually over quite a bit, a little over halfway toward Memphis, near north of Jackson. And he was there with his wife, Sue. She had had cancer. And they told him that she would not last until morning. He didn't have the same quality doctor that Mrs. Johnson did. But anyway, Tommy called me and I said, well, Tommy, I will come by on my way. I'll come in the morning on my way, or about lunchtime, on my way up to Bowling Green, and I will anoint her. And I remember it was on the 11th floor of Vanderbilt Medical Center. So with the Vanderbilt University Medical Center and in Nashville. And I said something in the anointing I've never said before. I said, we are just like the woman who grasped the hem of the garment of Jesus. We are grasping his garment and trusting in the power that you've placed in Jesus Christ. And I guess before I got to Bowling Green, she was healed. And they checked. It was so startling that they said nurses were bringing other nurses in to see her, that they were having people come through just to look at her, look at the chart, and look at this woman who was completely well. They got up, left the hospital, stopped at her favorite restaurant, which is Cracker Barrel, and had a meal on the way home. And you know, but this was strange because over, just like the lady who died of a heart attack, Mrs. Johnson, that was 6 months later. A year later, Sue developed cancer again and she died. Now, Tommy did not get bitter. He actually was thankful. He said, I got another year with my wife. And so he thanked God. Another one that had the same thing, we had an older man, Everett Corbin, over in Murfreesboro. I wasn't pastoring the church there anymore. I used to pastor that also. But David Dobson has it, but he had cancer, and I went over. This was interesting. Two men over there had cancer. One was relatively young, and the other was relatively old. I went by and just to visit them as a friend and pray for them. And Everett Corbin was on, he was taking strong medicine for the pain, and he was on hospice. And I anointed him and asked God. I prayed for both men. Don't remember if I anointed them. I prayed for them. I may have anointed them. You were with me, weren't you, Lucretia, for both of those men? Anyway, his pain went away. He quit taking medicine. He was fine. He went off of hospice. And he went over a year. And then the cancer came back on him. But he was fine. Why did God? I don't know. Everett Corbin. Our son-in-law, Matt Puckett, had a tick bite, and the doctor truly felt that he got Lyme disease. He was having pain all over his body. They gave him antibiotics. The pain went away. He went home. The pain came back. Apparently, the Lyme disease was coming back. But Matt said, I don't want to take antibiotics. So he asked me to send out a prayer request. We sent out the prayer request, and the pain went away, and he's been fine ever since. So we don't get many of those, do we? But God can still heal, and He hasn't forgotten us. But you know something? He's allowing God's people to be tested. We were all tested in 1995. And the majority failed the test. And we're still being tested. God, how many will go to a place of safety? Another question is, how many will be in God's kingdom? Now that could be discouraging, couldn't it? But you know, my purpose is not to discourage us, but to let us see that if God isn't intervening the way we want Him to, He's doing it deliberately. He's allowing us to be tested to see who is going to be in His kingdom. And the point of what Jesus said was that men ought always to pray and not lose heart. And it is easy when you aren't getting the answers you want to lose heart. And I'm encouraging you to know that we're in the middle of a test. That's what it is. It's a test. And we've all been tested. Everybody gets tested. This is just a little worse in some ways than some of the things. He's bearing long. And yet, you know something? There are many times when God did this. If you read the Psalms, how often does it say, "How long, O Lord, will you forget me forever? How long will you hide your face from me?" That's Psalm 113, verses 1 and 2. How long will you forget me forever? Here's some others. We do not see our signs. There's no longer any prophet, nor is there any among us who knows how long. That's Psalm 74, verses 9 and 10. Here, verse 10 says, "Lo, Lord, O God, how long will the adversary reproach?" Psalm 79, verse 5, don't turn. "How long, Lord, will you be angry forever? Will your jealousy burn like fire?" Psalm 80, verse 4, "O Lord of hosts, how long will you be angry against the prayer of your people?" God does this every now and then. We should not lose heart. We should stay close. We should be praying. We should trust God even to death. And I want to turn to a verse that is encouraging to me. It says, Peter wrote and said, "You've been grieved by various trials, that the genuineness of your faith, being much more precious than gold that perishes." It even mentions that God allows division to test genuineness. Mentions that, just Paul wrote that in 1 Corinthians 11. That the genuineness of your faith, that he says, you know, God allows that to see who's genuine. It's one of the translations. But I want to turn to Habakkuk chapter 3. Verse 17 through 19. You know, the Bible says, "Strive, Lord, are there few who are saved?" Remember they asked Jesus that in Luke 13? "Lord, are there few who are saved?" I'd like for him to say, "Well, no, there are going to be lots saved." But he didn't say that. He said, "Strive to enter through the narrow gate. For many, I say to you, will seek to enter and will not be able." So we've got to not give up on the prayer and study. We can't get discouraged just because God's allowing potential discouragement. Habakkuk 3. Habakkuk came to God and he said, "God," just a short little book, and it's written in poetry, so it's hard to understand. Commentary will help you through it if you want. But he starts it off and he says, "How long are you going to allow Israel, Judah, to be horrible sinners? And you do nothing." And God said, "Don't worry, Habakkuk. I'm going to send a terrible nation against Judah to punish them. The Babylonians." Or was it the Assyrians? I don't remember. Babylonians, I think. Habakkuk says, "The Babylonians? Lord, you're fair. They're worse than we are." And then God says, and Habakkuk says, "I'm going to go and I'm going to wait for God to answer. How's he going to use a worse nation than us to punish us?" Of course, he knew they needed punishment. God came back and he said, "Habakkuk, after I've done that, then I'm going to punish the Babylonians." Well, all that could be discouraging. But he says in Habakkuk chapter 3, verse 17 through 19, "Though the fig tree may not blossom, nor fruit be on the vines, though the labor of the olive may fail, and the fields yield no food, though the flock may be cut off from the fold, and there be no herd in the stalls." And here's the answer for us too. "Yet I will rejoice in the Lord. I will joy in the God of my salvation. The Lord God is my strength. He will make my feet like deer's feet, and he will make me walk on my high hills." Well, I still have 30 seconds to talk about my grandchildren. Right? Tell you, but I don't have enough to tell you about all 9 of them, so. Nice to be here with you.